Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true?
They don't think Christianity's true.
They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
For the second week in a row, a pressing current event or current events are forcing us, ladies and gentlemen, to address a cultural issue that we cannot ignore. Last week, we started to address the issue of racial hostility with my friend, Pastor Derwin Gray. Go back and listen to that podcast if you did not hear that. But today we're going to continue the discussion from another perspective. Question: how should Christians respond to the growing police dilemma? Some people out there believe that the cops have gone wild. Have they? What can we learn from both sides of this issue? And maybe a better question is this: how can we make both sides into one side? And what are some things that may change the way that you think about police officers? Now, before I introduce my guest today, let me reiterate what I mentioned at the top of last week's show. This is a complex issue that normally raises more heat than light. It's an emotional issue. It has multiple facets and multiple causes. Do not take any one comment on this program out of context. Listen to the entire program. As always, we are going to be on this program correct, not politically correct. We're going to tell the truth, even if the truth on its surface may appear to be insensitive or offensive. We don't intend it to be that way, but sometimes the truth hurts people. Sometimes the truth is offensive to people. Sometimes people don't like the truth. They want to suppress the truth, because the truth in some way convicts them. As Jesus said, men love darkness rather than light. And Paul said we suppress the truth and unrighteousness to go our own way. So forgive us. We're going to hopefully tell the truth. And if you don't think we're telling the truth here, you can send us an email at crossexamine.org. Seminars. Or send it to Frank at crossexamine.org. Send an email. I'll be happy to try and get back to you. Now, the man who can bring some light to this issue from another perspective is my friend who's been on this program several times before. He and I worked together quite a bit. He is the great J. Warner Wallace. He was a cop. His father was a cop. Now his son is a cop in California. So he's well qualified to talk about this issue. You know, he's written several excellent apologetics books. One of them is called Cold Case Christianity. His website is coldcasechristianity.com. The newest book is called God's Crime Scene, another book you need to have. As you know, he co-teaches Fearless Faith seminars with me. He also is one of our instructors at the Cross-Examine Instructor Academy, which is now full, by the way. And by the way, Jim has also been on Dateline several times, solving cold case homicides that are decades old. He's been a cop in some of the most hostile environments you can be a cop in. So we're going to get Jim's perspective on the program today. Jim, as always, great to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. You're right, though. This is one of those issues that does tend to raise more heat than light. So that's just the way it is.
Well, let's start out by raising some heat right away, Jim. This is going to sound provocative and unfair, but I'm saying this to the audience now. Hear us out. Police sometimes use race or other external characteristics to either prevent crime or catch a criminal. Now, Jim, you wrote an article called Six Things That May Change the Way You Think About Police Officers. You can access that article at crossexamine.org or coldcasechristianity.com, either one. This is just a few days ago. Again, six things that may change the way you think about police officers. And one of the six things in there, Jim, is that you say that police officers don't work aimlessly. And this section explains why race is sometimes a factor in pulling people over. In fact, even before we get to race, you give an example of a redheaded person. Explain this concept to us, would you?
Well, I think sometimes people think that police officers, when they're on patrol, one of the very few unusual, unique things about police work is we do patrol. You're asking us not just to respond to crimes, but actually to patrol areas to prevent crimes and to stop crimes before they occur. There aren't any patrolling firemen, but there are patrolling police officers. And that's a distinct problem, really, for us, because how do you patrol? How do you effectively patrol your area? Well, a lot of us is just about being present, but often what typically guides us and what always guided me was that at the beginning of the shift, we have a briefing. And in that briefing, we look at things that occurred the shift before us or the day before us, or if we've been off for 3 days, 3 days before we came on duty. What we're looking for are crime trends in our beat that we can then address if they need to be addressed, if there is a crime series. So, for example, if I know I have a series of robberies in the north end of my town that have been committed by a redheaded white male in a tan compact car, well, then you know, and he was never caught, well, then you know I'm looking for a redheaded white male in a tan compact car on my shift today, and I'll probably give that area some extra patrol, and I'll be looking for anybody maybe who's driving down the street, driving slowly, looking at pedestrians, you know, because these are street robberies, so I want to see this behavior, and his physical description matches the description that has been offered on crime reports over the last 3 days. Now, that puts me in a dilemma because I'm really focusing my attention on what has already been reported to me. And officers do notice that there are some groups that are reported more often as suspects. And so we end up occasionally working in particular groups that put us in jeopardy. And here's what I mean. Nobody wants on either side of this debate to be lumped in and defined by the activity of a small subset of the group. So, for example, as police officers, we recognize that there are going to be some cops that are going to do the wrong thing or react too hastily, harshly or too hastily in a situation. We know that because we're fallen humans. We mm-hmm. all make these kinds of mistakes. And I don't want to be judged on the basis of the behavior of a small subset of my group. And the same is true, I'm sure, for African Americans who feel like they're being judged and stopped and looked at suspiciously based on the behavior of a small subset of their group. Now, I will tell you that is really the dilemma that police officers face. If, for example, there have been 10 crimes committed by one group in the last 3 days before I come back on duty, well, then that's the focus of my attention. I've got to look for those kinds of suspects. And it doesn't matter to me what kind of suspect they are. But if they are of one group, well, then you end up focusing on one group more than others. Now, I got to tell you, Frank, I don't like this that way. I'm not happy about it. I'm not pleased about it. I wish it was different. I wish there was something I could even do to change the foundational problems that create this. But what we see, at least nationally, and what I've seen in our region of Southern California, is that, yes, based on the percentages of how we fill out the population, that there have been times when African Americans have been responsible for far more of the crime that we see, and so we've had to respond to that group. And that's a harsh reality that nobody likes, but if you look at the statistics, and I've linked to several national local surveys, we see that although we're only talking about 13 or 14% of the population, we are talking about numerically many more times the amount of crime based on percentage. We've got to figure out how to solve that problem, but cops are kind of stuck having to respond to it.
So, and this comes from the article, if you want the details on this, that Jim wrote, Six Things That May Change the Way You Think About Police Officers. You write in here, for example, you say a 2012 study revealed that African-American teenagers committed six times more murders, three times more rapes, 10 times more robberies, and three times more assaults than white teenage offenders. Now, some will say, Jim, well, wait a minute. These statistics are related to arrests, and you write in here, one could argue that arrest statistics simply prove the point. Police are racist. What's the counter to that? Is that possible?
Right. So what happens here is if you look at the studies that are actually looking at the number of listed suspects on crime reports, in other words, they're very, very, very much parallel the arrests. So it's not like we go out and we decide to create a dilemma. We create the crime reports by arresting African-Americans. It's instead that African-Americans are listed prior to us starting our shift on crime reports, and then we go out and respond to the crime reports. So the crime reports create the arrests. The arrests don't create the crime reports. And that's the problem, is this stuff kind of precedes us before we even begin our shift. And then you're just stuck dealing with what you have in your city. And it may be different for other people, but for us in Southern California, that's what we've been seeing.
This is a difficult problem, but we have to, in order to solve a problem, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to at least identify the truth before we can solve it. So we're trying to identify some controversial, but I think they're true issues here, and we're going to talk more with my friend Jay Warner Wallace, a former cold case homicide detective. Many a lot of experience, and we're back in just 2 minutes. Don't go away. If you're fiddling, easy for me to say, if you're fiddling around low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here, as uncomfortable as the truth might be. You're not going to hear this on NPR, trust me. My guest today is cold case homicide detective Jay Warner Wallace, who has many years of experience as a police officer. And we're talking about this issue of racial hostility. And as we pointed out last week on the program with my friend Derwin Gray, Pastor Derwin Gray, this is really not a race issue. It's an ethnicity issue, in the sense that we're all one race, the human race, and we may have different ethnicities, but we're all made in the image of God. We're all part of the same race. So we need to keep that in mind. And a little bit later in the program, we'll talk about how can we make both sides of this issue into one side. What can we do as Christians? But we're trying to understand the mindset of police officers in general. And my friend Jay Warner Wallace can do that, because not only was he a cop, his father was a cop, his son is a cop, and he's very well trained in these issues. And so before the break, we were talking about why it may seem like police officers are targeting one particular ethnic group over another. Now, you write also in this article, Jim, you say that police officers are disappointed about this. How so? What do you mean?
Or the uncomfortable truth about it. And I think sometimes both sides want to deny they've got any problem. So officers will sometimes say, well, this is, every single one of these shootings is justified. You just don't understand us. Which, you know, many of those shootings may be justified when all the things shake out and the investigation is done. But to argue that there's never going to be somebody who does something they shouldn't do is just stupid, because you're ignoring the nature of anthropology, of who we are as a species. We make mistakes. We are, now from a Christian perspective, we know why that's the case. We are designed in God's image, but deeply rebellious and fallen. And that group, of you're pulling from that same fallen group for no matter what group you're looking at. That's true for cops. We cannot deny that there are going to be problems. And this is also true, though, for any ethnic group that we're dealing with. I'm sure if I was part of any of these groups, I would be saying, hey, we've got no problem. Well, of course, we all have a problem. We've got to decide how we're going to address our problems. And I think both sides have to begin by saying, yeah, here's our problem. We have, at times, maybe we make mistakes. We can try to train, do better, vet better, hire better, all the things we want to do. But in the end, we're still dealing with fallen humans. On the other side, we have to acknowledge the fact that what we're dealing with here is an increase in criminal behavior that we could address. We have to address it. But police officers are not going to be in the best position to look at it from a preventative perspective. We're stuck having to respond, unfortunately, to the situation the way it is today. And that makes it more difficult for us. And so, yeah, are we disappointed about it? Absolutely. But, you know, Frank, what I often think is that we have to be, in order to bridge this, that requires each of us to take a step on that bridge and come toward each other. You don't get across the bridge unless you start walking. And so each of us has to kind of own up to what we can do better. And to say that none of us, that both sides are immune to criticism and could not honestly say we could do better, is a fool's game.
Again, the article is called Six Things That May Change the Way You Think About Police Officers. My guest is Jay Warner Wallace. I'm Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examine with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. Now, Jim, you also write in this article, and this is going to sound provocative as well. This is a quote from the article. You can unpack it. Officers are not required to suffer an injury before responding with an appropriate level of force. Explain.
Well, think about that for a second. Officers are not, we're not trained to wait until they fire a round at us before we fire back, because it seems like the luck of officers is that the round will be fired toward us, will hit us in the forehead, and we won't be able to fire back. So our only time we're ever going to address force with the level of force we would say is deadly force is if we feel that our life is about to be taken, or the life of an innocent we're trying to protect is about to be taken. When the level of threat is that high, then we respond accordingly. We have a threat continuum, a force continuum. We have lots of options to choose from, and we try not to use an option which is unduly, a reasonable person would say, well, he shouldn't have gone that hard. If you use your fist, we're going to try to use our hands. If we have to raise the level to a baton or to a taser, we're going to do that. We're trying to stay one step ahead of the injury which would incapacitate us and take us out of the game. So we're not obligated to be taken out of the game before we can, you know, respond, because then we can't respond. So what we're going to do is, when we see a threat we think reasonably is a deadly threat, we're going to respond in kind. So if I know I'm approaching somebody who's been identified, or someone has said, hey, he just robbed that store, don't even know if he's the right guy, but this guy points him out, and I run over to him, and I tell him to stop, and he now is not cooperating with me, and he suspiciously reaches down into the pocket when the guy told me that this guy was armed, well, now I'm going to think, what is he reaching for? Now, he may pull out his wallet, but how do I even know what he's pulling out? If I wait, these things happen, by the way, shootings happen in a millisecond. You'd be amazed to see how quick knife attacks occur. But shootings are instantaneous. I really can't wait to make sense of whether that's a wallet or I just took the first round because it was a gun. And so this is the nature of the kind of work we do, and we often have to respond at that level quickly, making a split-second decision, which will be judged for the rest of our lives, about whether that thing in his hand was about to be used to kill us.
Yeah, the last thing a cop wants to do is to shoot somebody, I'd imagine. And I think you write that in the article here, because it's going to just create not only, obviously, a tragic situation, but it's going to create a lot of problems for that police officer moving forward, isn't it?
Well, and I don't think I even said this in the article, but yeah. I've worked officer-involved shootings on the OIS team for 5 years. And I can tell you that I several times would talk to officers afterwards that were, you know, deeply troubled by the fact that they hadn't even killed anybody. They had just shot at somebody, and they were so upset about it. They would say things like, "Why didn't he just do what I told him to do?" Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense that, you know, the last thing we want to get involved in. These are real people who wear that blue uniform. I realize that the persona they sometimes put off, that we all put off sometimes, is can be very, very detached and neutral. But the reality of it is, we still go home at night, and we still think about these things at night, and they still bother us. They plague us. And I think what happens is you kind of get this sense, either from experiences we had. By the way, Frank, sometimes, you know, I always use this analogy. I didn't use it in the article, but if you're speeding through an intersection, I have a choice when I walk up on your car. If I stop you, I can assume you're just late for dinner, or I can assume you're speeding from the scene of a robbery you want to get as far away from as possible. I can assume you're just late, or I can assume you have a gun in the car and you're running from something. Now, as crazy as this sounds, if I assume the first thing, I might not go home tonight. If I assume the second, I will walk up on the car differently. I will make different kinds of requests of you in the first 30 seconds. But I will do it safely in a way that prevents me from getting hurt in case, by odd chance, it happens to be the second situation. So I will often walk up on the car a little more coolly, asking the driver, put your hands on the steering wheel, please don't move your hands, and I'll start asking those questions. Now, as the driver, you may feel like, why is this guy treating me like a robbery suspect? This is ridiculous. He's a jerk. But in fact, it's just the way we approach, not knowing for sure that a whole goal of every shift is to get home at the end of the shift. And that's what we'll sometimes walk up on that car just in the first 30 seconds. Now, if we're good at this, we will take the time to explain to the driver why it is that we treated him that way for a few minutes, because we need to kind of make sure that our citizenry knows we're just trying to do this job in a way that's safe for us. Now, not everyone's good at communicating that, and not every driver will even listen to you once you've offended them by treating them like an armed suspect in the first 30 seconds when all they were was late for dinner. So I think that this is part of the dilemma we face.
It's a very difficult job, and you would know far better than me, Jim. I couldn't imagine trying to do that, walk up to a car not knowing what is inside that car or who's inside that car. It's got to be very, very difficult. And the decisions you have to make in split seconds are life and death situations. And you actually link in a second article you wrote. The second article you wrote is called Six Ways Christians Can Respond to the Growing Police Dilemma. Just came out Friday. And in there, you talk about educating with a purpose, and you highlight, you actually link to a story about a Black Lives Matter protester being invited by, I think it was the Phoenix PD, to engage in a scenario, a life or death scenario as a police officer. What happened in that scenario?
Yeah, it's one of the ways we can do to educate ourselves is each side has to step toward the center and get a view from the other side. I mean, we have to do that as law enforcement, and so does the public. And so we often will run these kind of shoot or don't shoot trainings with each other, where we'll put a role player out there and he'll, you know, be in a scenario and the officer's got to decide in a split second, does he shoot or does he not shoot? So they did the same scenario with a leader of the Black Lives Matters movement in Phoenix. And it was interesting to see that in that particular scenario, that leader ended up being shot by one of the role players because he didn't act quick enough. And in the other one, he shot an unarmed man because he felt like he was being threatened. Now, this is typically what we end up doing in real life. And of course, if we do that, we are immediately castigated right in the press. How could you shoot an unarmed man? But when you actually go through the scenario, and if you watch that, I've got the link there at the website, you can actually watch that video. You'll see how quickly it happens. Even the news reporter who went along for the ride, he actually went through the scenario himself and ended up doing the exact same two things. So it helps you to get insight into how difficult that quick decision is when you're not sure. Again, this is one of the other things, too, is that it's a level of training issue, right? We want to train our officers because if this the shooter in that particular scenario, the leader who ended up shooting the unarmed role player, he felt like he couldn't handle the imposing threat of this large role player who was coming towards him with just his bare hands. And since he had his gun drawn already, he felt like he had only one alternative, which was to pull the trigger. Now, if the leader himself had been a 6'5", 350-pound muscled grappler from the UFC, he probably would have felt like he could handle that guy. So it turns out the more training you do and the more effective a grappler you are, the less likely you are to have to resort to a higher level of force to handle something because you feel like I can handle this with my hands. And that's the problem, is we're always going to have a suspect in the field who's bigger than we are. We're always going to have a suspect in the field who's a better ground fighter than you are. You know, there's always going to be somebody out there who's better, stronger, wiser, whatever it may be as far as ground fighting. So you end up having to use a level of force to control the situation that doesn't afterwards make sound reasonable to some people because they think, hey, he's unarmed. Well, yeah, he's a 6'5" charging suspect who's unarmed, and if I don't do something, he's going to wrestle me to the ground, take my gun, and execute me with it. So what are the options that are left to me? You know, you have to kind of figure out what to do.
Yeah, it's a very difficult scenario, and I urge you to take a look at this article as well that my friend and guest Jay Warner Wallace has written. It's called Six Things That May Change the Way You Think About Police Officers, and the one with the link to the scenario that we were just discussing is called Six Ways Christians Can Respond to the Growing Police Dilemma. You can find them both at coldcasechristianity.com, and that second one just came out yesterday, Friday, so check that out. We come back more with Jim Wallace, cold case homicide detective, author of Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. I'm Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. We're going to address more of these issues when we come back, so do not touch that dial. We're back in two. How should we, as Christians and citizens, address the ethnic hostility that appears to be going on between police officers and the African-American community? What can we do about that? What are the facts surrounding it? And let me, before I get back to my guest, Jim Wallace, let me reiterate something I mentioned last week about facts. Obviously, some cops, hopefully a very small minority, are racist, and there are highly publicized instances of police brutality. And we don't always know what they're caused by. Certainly there was much more racist police brutality in our country 50 years ago. And obviously, whenever this happens, cops need to be prosecuted. However, there's a problem here. And the problem is the perception that we get today from the videos that we see might not always reflect the entire reality. We must be very careful about distinguishing between anecdotal data and scientific data, about cherry picking versus getting a complete, accurate picture by looking at all of the scientific evidence. So when you see something on TV, an isolated incident may or may not give you an accurate picture of what's happening nationwide. For an accurate picture, though, you actually need scientific data. And the scientific data, as we mentioned earlier in the program, are showing that cops are interacting more with black assailants because, for reasons we'll talk about a little bit later, blacks are committing a disproportionate number of crimes. Now, I'm not suggesting that police brutality or racism isn't real. I'm just trying to understand the environment in which such incidents might be occurring. And perhaps this data will help us figure out how to solve this. That's the issue here. But let's not just look at an incident and apply it to the entire group. In fact, I tweeted this out earlier this week. I said, just like no one should judge all black men by the shooter in Dallas, no one should judge all cops by the brutal. Wherever there's a cop who's engaging in police brutality, we don't judge all cops by one, just like we don't judge all people in an ethnic group by one mass murderer. So we have to keep all that in mind. Now, with that being said, my friend Jim Wallace, who's my guest today, the cold case homicide detective, in his article, Six Ways Christians Can Respond to the Growing Police Dilemma, Jim, you have a very interesting point here. Point number three, it says, be a patient leader. And this goes right to the point we just made about anecdotal data and scientific data. Explain the patient leader comment.
Yeah, a couple of things about that. I think that you're right. You're absolutely right about judging a larger group or any subset from any subset of that group. And so here's the problem: both sides would agree with that, like you just said in your tweet. Mm-hmm. And that is true for officers too. I mean, we have over 900,000 sworn officers nationwide. Okay, that's a lot of people who are involved. And when you think about it, it's not just the officers you have to measure this metric against. It's really about calls for service and all the calls for service that happen nationally. The question, of course, is what percentage of those end up in violent interactions, and then what percentage of those violent interactions end up with an officer or an arrest-related death. Now, if you look at those numbers, you can get a better picture broadly of where we're at. And it's hard to keep track of the number of calls for service. The most recent kind of credible data I can find is from about 2011, when about 35 million between calls for service and I would guess another 10% for interaction that is, just a proactive interaction of police officers. So I would guess right around 35 million contacts with the population. About 13% of the population will be involved with contacts with police. So about 35 million contacts, and in that year, how many deaths occurred? Let's use the higher level of deaths from 2015. That was 986 deaths occurred at the hands of police officers. If you use those statistics, low statistics for number of contacts, high statistics for numbers of deaths at the hands of police officers, you're still only looking at 0.003% of all police contacts ended in any death of this nature. And how many of those deaths were unwarranted? Let's say all of them were unwarranted. That is not the case. 75% of those were in response to an attack on the officer or on somebody the officer was trying to protect. So I don't think it's going to be all of them are going to be unwarranted. But even if they were, Frank, that's only 0.003% of police contacts in that year. So that means we are looking largely at the videotape we see on the 0.003% and then casting that image over the 99.997%. And that's something we have to be very careful not to do. At the same time, I want to be careful not to say we don't have a problem. We don't have something we need to address. Of course we do. Why do you think officers train in ethics and defensive tactics consistently? But one of the things I see, you mentioned here, which is about patience and leadership, is that I've worked for a number of chiefs in my career that changed our department. And an old partner of mine is now the chief of police there. And I can tell you that every one of these chiefs was incredibly frustrating to the press, but patient in his response. Knew better than to come out in the first 24 hours, and even if it looks like a bad shooting, even if it looks like something that's going to be hard to understand how the officer could actually do this or, legally and justifiably do something, the chief would stop and short of really judging the officer in the first 24 hours publicly. Instead, he would say, look, this officer has been removed from duty. This officer is no longer working the streets. It's on administrative leave right now and will not be back in touch with the community until we have this sorted out. We've got a team now, sometimes even involving the district attorney's office, that will be looking at this activity and investigating it thoroughly. And at the end of that investigation, when all the facts are in, I'll have a more detailed statement for you. Now, the press was always frustrated with that kind of response. But this is the wisest thing to say, because what even might look compelling on video once you understand what's in the mind of the officer and the sequence of events that occurs prior to the event, it might be mitigated. You just don't know. Mm. And one thing you can't do, though, is assume you know before you know. And so good leaders end up frustrating the press because they don't say anything early on. And that's why when a public leader at any level gets on social media and says something about a shooting of any nature in the first 24 hours before the facts are in, you're making a mistake. Now, look, we also do this as Christians and as citizens, don't we? Orlando occurs, and we think immediately this is Islamic terrorism. Of course, it may be, and it ends up being that's the case. That's the driving factor. But in the first 24 hours, I'm more inclined to shut up until all the facts are in, because I want the same grace afforded to law enforcement when a situation occurs and we don't have all the facts yet. So for me, I want to be as gracious as I want people to treat me. And I think leadership leads by waiting until you know everything there is to know before you pop off and make a statement. And we have to lead as Christians right now in the culture that we cannot quickly condemn the other side when we might feel like we should or we want to. We have to wait. And then we can make the case that, hey, you should have waited also. But we can't make that case if we also are doing the same thing.
You know, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but it's true, and I'm going to be correct, not politically correct. President Obama needs to hear this particular message from you here, Jim, because as soon as something like this happens, he immediately blames the police officers. On the other hand, after we know, after a thorough investigation, that jihad has occurred on our soil, he still refuses to call it what it is. So he's quick to judge police officers, but he won't judge anybody who is proven to be a jihadist by calling him what he is. That's just very bad leadership.
Let me illustrate the problem even in a little more kind of reference ways to law enforcement.
Yeah.
You know, if you come out and you make a statement and you've got a large following on social media, if you're a leader in the nation and you make, I say you're a congressman and you make a statement about a local in your jurisdiction, or a shooting that occurred in your jurisdiction, and you proclaim it to be a bad shooting, and then all the facts come in and a jury actually determines that there's no criminal responsibility on the part of the officer. Well, now what it looks like, the system is somehow rigged.
Yeah. Can
and
you say Baltimore?
No one would have said that if you wouldn't have said anything. But as the leader, they believe what you said initially. And then when all the facts, because you didn't have all the facts, and the jury now does have all the facts, and that jury of 12 people, not acting in a conspiracy, just doing their job as jurors, decides that that officer or whatever is not criminally responsible. Well, now there's this kind of shadow of doubt over the jury's deliberations and the jury's decision that really wouldn't have been there if you hadn't created it by saying something in the first place. And that's why it's really important for us as leaders to be patient, because we have to. You wouldn't want this done toward you and your group, and I don't want that done toward me and my group. So I want to be careful that, first of all, I own when I do it, and then two, I call it out when somebody else does it.
Now, I've been only following this from a distance, and maybe you know more about it than I do, Jim. But the Attorney General, I think, in Baltimore, has stepped in it, because she, I think, came out talking about the trial up there, the gentleman who died in police custody. I can't recall his name right now. Freddie Gray, was it? Am I thinking right here?
Freddie
Is
Gray.
That the right name? And every time this thing gets before a jury or goes to trial somehow, the officers are acquitted. And it just speaks right to your point. People are going, well, wait a minute. It was a slam dunk, according to the Attorney General. You know.
Well, so for me, what I want to be consistent. Right. So I want to be consistent in this, too, and say, okay, you're seeing a similar process. I have no idea what the details of that case are.
Right.
I haven't
neither
tracked
why.
That case.
Yeah.
So again, rather than do the very thing I'm saying we ought not do, I'm just going to trust that whoever is looking at those facts, if it is a jury or if it's a judge or whoever it may be, that they're in the best position after seeing the best that both sides can throw, because the prosecution is going to give it everything they have and the defense is going to give it everything they have. And in the end, that jury is tasked with determining what happened.
Right.
And so I have to rest with it. By the way, Frank, this is also, I have to rest with it when it comes to a decision that maybe I would say I don't think was right. And in some criminal trial, I think the guy got off. Well, okay, that this is what our process does. I want to be fair with that process. And I try to accept verdicts one way or the other.
What I was saying is I think that the mayor and maybe the attorney general in Baltimore, they were poisoning the well by their comments, which weren't patient comments, as you mentioned. But let me move on to another.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. I think, frankly, so one last thing on that. Yeah. I think you're right when you say this. If somebody responds in the first 24 hours or 48 hours of any incident, I already assume they don't really are speaking too soon, because there's no way you could have that kind of data in that short period of time. So I'm always looking for those statements that come out 3 weeks into the investigation. Those are probably going to be a little more balanced than the first 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Now, you noticed some things regarding the family life of most criminals that we'll talk about right after the break, Jim. And then we'll also talk about a couple of things that Christians can do to help heal this issue, or at least move it forward. So we don't want to be just talking about the problems. We also want to be talking about the solutions. So that's what we're going to do here when we come back from the break. My guest today is Jim Wallace. His website, coldcasechristianity.com. You need to check that out. He's also on our website, crossexamined.org. He's written two articles in the past week on this issue, well qualified to write on these issues. One of them is called Six Ways Christians Can Respond to the Growing Police Dilemma. The other's called Six Things That May Change the Way You Think About Police Officers. So check him out at crossexamined.org and coldcasechristianity.com. I'm Frank Turk. We're back in just 2 minutes with our final segment and some solutions to this problem. Don't go away. Welcome back to Cross Examined with Frank Turk and the American Family Radio Network. Our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. If you don't have the Cross Examined app yet, you need to have it. We're up to 102,000 downloads on that app. And there's another great app you got to get, the Cold Case Christianity app as well. Jim puts out a podcast every week as well, my guest, Jay Warner Wallace. So check that out as well. And this week, I'll be in Rock Hill, South Carolina, right near my hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina, at a church there. And the following week, I'll be in Raleigh, North Carolina. So I'm staying close to home the next couple of weeks. So if you're anywhere near Raleigh or the Charlotte area, this week Charlotte, next week Raleigh, love to see you. Now, Jim, you're on the road a lot, too. Where are you going to be in the next week or two, so people can know?
I'm in Prescott today, Saturday, and tomorrow, Sunday. And then I'm in back in Colorado for Summit Worldview Conference next week. And then I think I'm in Houston next.
Houston. Oh, all right. You're going to be down in Houston.
Houston,
so check Jim's calendar out and follow him a little bit. His calendar's on our website as well, crossexamined.org. I'm going to be at Summit this week, next week, too. That's such a great ministry. Summit.org, ladies and gentlemen. Check it out. Now, Jim, you were in the article, Six Ways Christians Can Respond to the Growing Police Dilemma. You have a very interesting point in here that I want you to unpack for us. You say, love the other side because there is no other side. This is the beginning of the solution phase, ladies and gentlemen. Explain that, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, Obama said this, right? The president said this over the weekend or last week during the memorial, where he said that faced with this violence, we wonder if the divides of race in America can ever be bridged. Well, I think we could bridge these by, first of all, you know, like we said, we have to take steps on the bridge before we could ever bridge anything. And I think what we have to do is recognize that what we have in common far outweighs what divides us. And you may think, oh, that's just not true. But it is, from a Christian perspective. If you believe Christianity is true, then here's what you know. You know that all of us have three important characteristics in common. First, we're created in the image of God. You see that in Genesis 1:27. Second, you know, we're deeply rebellious. We're fallen, sinful creatures. And that we see that, of course, in Romans 3 and 1 John 1. And then finally, you know that every one of us is desperately in need of a Savior. Those three things we all have in common. Those are the foundational worldview questions, right? How do we get here? Why is it so messed up? And how do we fix it? And it turns out we all share the same dilemma and the same problems and the same answers, really. So you're able to get along with your crazy family at Thanksgiving for a reason, because you know your crazy family is still your family. Well, it turns out we're all members of the human family. We just choose not to. I always say the problem is not racism, it's otherism. We are inclined to divide along anything that makes you look like something other than me. So even if we all all men looked exactly the same on the planet and all women looked exactly the same on the planet, we'll find something to divide over. As a matter of fact, I would say, well, he lives in an odd address on the north side of the street, and I live on the even side of the street. All the odds, they're odd. But you can find something to divide yourself from your a person on the other side of the street. It just so happens in this case that ethnicity, your color of your skin, is a quick, easy thing to identify. But it's not really about this. It's about the fallen nature we have to always want to divide from our brother. And that counterintuitive compassion that Jesus offers, where he says, hey, you should be loving your enemies and praying for those who persecute you, applies even greater, of course, to those of us who are in the same family and we're in the same human family. And let's just end with one thing. Since we're talking about family, Frank, the one thing I noticed over and over again in dealing with the gangsters I dealt, I worked 2 years in the gang detail in my city, and we had all kinds of different kinds of gangsters from all kinds of different economic backgrounds. We had a group of white gangsters, Hispanic gangsters, Asian gangsters, and African-American gangsters. So we're working with all these different groups, and I was kind of trying to figure out, because I had a 2- and a 4-year-old at the time, what is the common denominator that gets young men involved in gangs? Because clearly it didn't seem to be race, it didn't seem to be economic status, it didn't seem to be, you know, your ethnic lineage, because I had very different kinds of gangsters and very different kinds of backgrounds all involved in gang activity. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, man, what is the common denominator here? And so as I spent time on the street, and I would do this every day, driving up, getting out of the car, and just talking to gangsters, what I discovered was that they all had the same problem: lack of dad. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. I remember one time being at a meeting, a room full of citizens, and they're asking me, they're there for a gang meeting, they're asking me, what are you guys doing, to our two officers who were there that night, what are you guys doing to keep our kids out of gangs? And I looked at the room, and I said, wow, actually nothing. We really can't keep your kids out of gangs. All we can do is deal with the outcome of those kids who are in gangs and protect the kids who aren't in gangs from the kids who are in gangs, and sometimes the gangsters from each other. But the problem is, really, before we even get on the shift, and I looked around the room and I realized there were no men in that room. It was all women,
yeah.
Desperately concerned. Many of them devout Christians, desperately concerned that they cannot seem to keep their young men in line. And it all comes down to lack of dad. And that's very different for different groups. Sometimes it's because your dad's a workaholic. He's never home. He's focused on his career. He's maybe a deadbeat who's just drunk on the couch all the time, or he's been incarcerated for most of his adult life, or you never knew him because you never stayed with your mom. There can be different reasons why each of us suffers from lack of dad. It doesn't really matter what starts it. The consequence was very convicting for me. Because here I am as this workaholic police officer, and I'm wondering, is my workaholism is no different than anyone else's absence from their kids? Mm-hmm. And I had to ask myself, am I leaving my son? You know, am I available for them? Am I doing what it says in Deuteronomy 6? You know, am I impressing God's word on them as we're walking, sitting at home and walking on the road and lying down and sitting up? And, you know, am I available for my kids? Now, look, this is the tough truth that nobody wants to admit. In these families where in which gangsters are raised and come out and involved in young men involved in criminal activity, typically don't involve active dads who are involved in the lives of their kids. It's just the studies are out there. I linked to several of them in the website on the article. But what we see over and over again evidentially is this. Kids do better in nearly every metric you measure, from incarceration rates to educational rates to income rates to drug abuse rates to teenage pregnancy rates. Almost every metric you can measure, kids do better when raised by two biological parents in a committed, low-conflict setting. It's as simple as that. One study even said that children with involved fathers have better social skills, more successful relationships, stronger self-esteem, more self-control, higher grades. They're less likely to be overweight, suspended from school, bully others, take drugs, or engage in risky sexual behavior, or commit crime. The study really reflects what I saw every day working in the gang detail, and I can tell you that Christians, we could step in the gap if we want to.
You know,
Susie and I have adopted kids mm-hmm. because we wanted to do something to solve a problem. This is also true for those of us who could work with young men. Because it turns out, you know, I wasn't even raised by my dad divorced my mom when I was 3, and he was not in my life. But I had role models because whenever he was around, he was a good role model. And my grandfather, his father, oh my gosh, was like this like icon of what it is to be a dad and a grandfather. Mm. I mean, he was just amazing. And even the contact I had with Warner, my namesake, right? Warner taught me how to be a man. And I model my life after Warner. And it turns out that there's even, as a young man, I can tell you that I actually modeled what I thought it was to be a man after characters on television. You know, if you remember The Rifleman, the model of a man in The Rifleman was really the first father that I drew. I thought that's a model for what it is to be a father. Is that crazy? Now think about how influential media can be.
Sure.
And how it was in my life. And now think about what kind of media we're seeing prevalent today and the model it's setting for young men today. Are we modeling what it is to be the kind of man we want our young men to be in the media today? Of course we're not. But the point is the church could, those of us in the church who want to engage young men and step in the void to lead young men, we have the opportunity. Those opportunities, the ministries are out there. They abound. The question is, are we willing to step in and do the hard work?
What are some of the ministries that come to mind, Jim, when you think about ministries that may provide some male leadership to kids that don't have male leadership? Are there any that right off the top of your head you go, yeah, that might be a good one?
Well, I know if you've ever talked to athletes will often, who are raised without a dad at home, will often talk about their experience with Big Brother programs, right? And
sure.
You think, oh, come on, that's like, you know, what? But really, that is actually, I remember as a kid, there was a Big Brother program, and here I have a dad, okay, but he was divorced from my mom. I'd see him a couple times a month, and there was a Big Brother program in the city I was living in, and I would actually attend it. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, don't think for a second that young men don't look at older versions of men and try to glean something from that. I know I did. Those programs are there. You've got a youth ministry in your own church, I bet, that is filled with young people who are from single parent homes.
Right.
And are men, you know, how many times men don't often volunteer sometimes in church ministries where they could actually make a huge impact. Have you noticed that sometimes church ministries seem to be more dominated by volunteers that are women than are men?
Mm-hmm.
We have to get involved. The role of men in the church and the role of men in the culture is important. We have to remember that the culture has tried to convince us that there's no difference between men and women, when in fact there is a huge difference between men and women. Both have things to bring to the table. Now, one is not better than the other. So I'm saying that one is better than the other. I'm saying we have to do our job, and we cannot surrender it to others.
Yeah, go down to your youth group in your church and see if you can volunteer. If you're bringing your sons or your kids out for a meal, if you know there's a kid out there who doesn't have a dad, maybe you can take him too, or her too, or whoever that is. I mean, it's so important, and we can just do these little things right in our own churches to help alleviate this problem. Jim, it's fabulous having you on the show, and your expertise in this matter is so well appreciated. Thanks for being on again, man.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Frank. You know, we're brothers, and I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, that's Jim Wallace. And again, his book is called Cold Case Christianity. His newest book is called God's Crime Scene. He's got a couple others coming out he'll tell you about next time. And also check out the two articles that he just wrote on this issue. Again, six ways Christians can respond to the growing police dilemma. We just covered a couple of them. And then six things that may change the way you think about police officers. Remember, we've got to base our opinions on these issues on the facts, not just media or not just the current zeitgeist. We've got to get the facts if we're going to be true Christians and follow the truth. I'm Frank Turk. See you next time. God bless.